It's the 1860s, and you've just had a family member die. Maybe it was smallpox or cholera, typhoid, or just one of the random accidents that happens to befall human life. Maybe it was your father or your mother, or your sister, or your brother. Regardless, you bury them in the proper funerary traditions and try to get on with your life. And then, maybe a week later, maybe only a few days later, you or someone you know is walking by the local medical school, one of the honored and most important institutions in your city. You know, looks really nice. Maybe it's got that Gothic architecture. And then they look up to the window and see that your relatives, your sisters, your brothers, your father's arm is hanging out of that window. A medical student is grabbing it and waving at all the passerbys down below. And you, or whoever told you this story, knows from a tattoo or some sort of marking on that arm that that is your relative's arm. What is it doing in the medical school? This sounds like science fiction. This sounds like the beginning of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And indeed, in a way, this is right out of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, because what happened between 1765 and 1884 were something called the Anatomy Riots. Five medical schools were burned down because medical students who were charged with learning anatomy on real human cadavers were caught with the bodies of local relatives. And then all of the citizenry gathered together with their pitchforks and their torches and came to the medical schools and burned them to the ground. This is a reality in our history. This has happened so many times. It's actually a common problem around the world and leads to actually a fundamental knowledge problem in medical science. On one hand, we want our doctors and our medical professionals to understand what is going on in the body with the best empirical analysis and evidence possible. And this means studying on dead bodies. On the other hand, someone has to give up their body for medical study. The real impetus for any sort of governmental reform actually started in the city of Edinburgh, where there were these two Irish immigrants. And this was in the late 1820s or early 1830s. It was William Hare and his partner named Burke, who owned a small little tenement house. And sometimes their tenants, they didn't pay their rent. So Burke and Hare would go in, assault, and murder their tenants who couldn't pay the rent, and then cart the bodies down to the local medical school and sell them for a profit to cover their losses. Well, the Burke and Hare murders were enormous sensations at the time. They inspired penny novels and plays. And even into this century, we still talk about those murders as grievous crimes. Well, there was so much outrage that it led to the Anatomy Act of 1832, which limited the ability for medical students to simply purchase bodies. You know, at that time, it wasn't just Burke and Hare. It was routine for your medical student on the first day of classes, when they had to learn to dissect their cadavers, to have to go to the local cemetery and literally dig up coffins of the recently deceased and acquire their own body for medical research. There was an entire profession called the resurrectionists that specialized in this sort of crime. And, you know, if you actually look at graveyards today, or especially the older models of graveyards, you'll notice that the burial vaults are actually sort of high security. You'll notice large cement or concrete over the tops of the graves. And that's not to keep the dead from rising. That was to keep the resurrectionists and the doctors out of your relatives' graves. So this story that I'm about to tell you begins to some degree with the Burke and Hare murders and the anatomy riots that plagued early America, but actually also talks about a fundamental problem of what is going on even to this day. Now, as you may know, I wrote a book several years ago. I think it came out in 2011, called The Red Market, On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. And it was, you know, in many ways, it's the book that identified the early part of my career as an investigative journalist, as I connected the material reality of human bodies to the economic systems that drive capitalism forward. And looking at the history of human skeletons actually gives us insight into the continued scandals that plague the medical industry, from, again, organ trafficking, you know, human kidneys being bought and sold around the world, the market for human eggs, even the market, the illegal market for human blood. Now, a lot of people will think of organ trafficking as almost like an urban myth, right? There's this story of someone who wakes up in a bathtub full of ice, and maybe they were on a vacation in Cancun, and they got a little drunk, and they met this really attractive woman who drugged them, and they woke up without their kidney, and all of a sudden, this leads into some sort of mafioso crime scandal. Well, that story, which you may know something about, is a complete lie. That's not how organ trafficking actually works. Instead, I spent 6 years going around the world and meeting the actual traffickers in human organs and body parts. And that's what eventually became that book, The Red Market. And the reason why I'm talking to you about skeletons is because what was happening, again, back in the 1800s is to some degree still going on today. So I'm going to tell you the history of the skeleton markets, and you can imagine exactly how insane all of this gets as we proceed to the modern day, where the speed of capitalism only grows faster and more profitable. After the Burke and Hare murders, England had a problem. So every doctor has to study on a skeleton, right? You don't want a doctor to set your bones if they don't even know what your bones look like. So these doctors have to acquire a corpse from somewhere. But all of a sudden, being a resurrectionist was no good. It was a problem. It was a stain on the reputation of medical schools everywhere. And yet, doctors had to get their bones, right? They had to study on corpses. So there still were resurrectionists working in England, but English entrepreneurs realized that skeletons, well, those don't decay quite so rapidly, right? They could actually get skeletons from somewhere else than the English countryside. At the time, England had an enormous reach around the world. The sun never set on the English Empire. And across the world, in the country of India, they had absolute control. So I imagine this as like some sunburned and pith-helmeted English chap flies over to Calcutta, which at the time was the capital of the Indian Empire, the British Raj in India. And he started looking around for places to purchase dead people. And I don't know who that entrepreneur was. His name is probably lost to time. However, what started to occur was that India became the world's preeminent supplier of human anatomical remains to the entire world. Over the course of about 100 years, from the 1860s to the 1980s, so it's actually 120 years, India's bone factories boomed, particularly in the state of West Bengal. So this is in Calcutta and south along the Bharathghati River. Just about everyone who died had a chance of having their remains exhumed and taken in to these bone factories that literally defleshed human bodies and prepared excellent medical specimens that then were shipped out to the entire world. One of them was the Reckness Company. One was Young Brothers. There were quite a few. And here's how it worked. Sometimes poor people would die, poor Hindus would die, and they didn't have enough money to cremate the body. So according to the local rituals, you could put a little bit of butter in the person's mouth and light the butter on fire, and that would stand in for a full cremation, because wood was expensive. And after the butter burned out, the people walked away, and the local caste of people who were charged with managing the bodies, a group called the Domes, would then be responsible for seeing that that body made it off into the afterlife, to reincarnation. And usually when the family left, they would gather up the bodies and wrap them in nets and put the nets in the local river. And after a day or two, or three or four, maybe even a full week, all of the flesh would get soggy and, well, you know, it would fall apart. Then the Domes would scrape the flesh off to reveal bones. And then they would boil the bones in something called caustic soda. And from there, these bones, they started to resemble a pretty bright white patina. The Domes would get paid more if they could keep all of the bones together in one anatomically complete specimen that then could be sent to Calcutta, where anatomists would wire them all together and then ship them out to the entire world. Most to England originally, but skeletons also made it to America, to Germany, to Thailand, to South Africa, really anywhere that there needed to be a medical program that had a demand for skeletons. Well, this trade boomed. It was an enormous affair. And by 1980, Calcutta was exporting 60,000 skeletons every single year. Now imagine that for a second. I live in Denver, and Denver has a population of 700,000 people. We don't have 60,000 people who die every year. If you died in Calcutta at any point in that time period, your relatives were sold abroad by the medical schools. If you go to the graveyards in Calcutta today, again, there are these concrete vaults over every grave, and then there are holes next to so many of those burial vaults where something has gotten in and pulled the body out. Now, this affected really everyone. It affected the Hindus who failed to be cremated. It affected the Muslim graves. It affected the Christian graves. It affected anyone who died. Again, this continued to 1980. And in 1980, what happened was a skeleton seller. Again, this is after the independence of India, but the trade still continued. And this one skeleton seller was found on a train with these huge burlap sacks full of children's skeletons. Now, children's skeletons get you a lot more money on anatomical markets because they're comparatively more rare. And they have interesting anatomical features that show how a body grows into a full-formed adult. And legitimately, important medical information comes out of them. But you have to get a dead child from somewhere. And this skeleton seller, it was alleged that he had murdered 1,500 children to get those skeletons. And I think, well, there could be something to that. There were riots across India, and soon India banned the entire foreign trade in human skeletons. It was no longer legal to export human skeletons around the world after that. Well, a domestic market still continued because, you know, local doctors still needed to get their own skeletons. But the trade itself, those 20 houses that were exporting human bones, well, they mostly went out of business. And when I say mostly went out of business, I don't mean that they went altogether out of business. In 2007, I took my first major magazine investigative feature. It was for Wired magazine. And I wanted to know if the market for human skeletons was still active in India. I'd read this article about a seizure of bones up somewhere in the state of West Bengal, and I hired a driver, I hired a translator. I speak Hindi, I don't speak Bengali. I'd made it to this rural area in West Bengal, and I met the local police chief, who was more than happy to show me what his find was. He opened up this evidence locker. And when I say evidence locker, it's not like what you might imagine it looks like in an American police department. It was the back of an SUV, a Tata Sumo SUV to be exact. He opened it up, and inside were these 8 burlap sacks. He opened up the back of the truck, and they clattered to the ground. The sacks actually fell out, and there was this hollow clatter on the inside. And I opened up the bag and saw it entirely full of human skulls. There were chips of teeth that had broken as they'd fallen out. And I picked up a skull. I brought it to my nose and I smelled it. And, well, this is strange, but it smelled like fried chicken, which is a little nauseating if you think about it. But the reason why it did have that smell is because this pristine white skull had been processed in caustic soda, which is a chemical that they use to deflesh it. These skeletons were probably worth at least $70,000, $80,000 on the local market, and who knows how much on the international market. These skeletons were processed by this organization called Young Brothers locally. And I decided that I was going to go figure out what was going on locally here in India, see where the skeletons were going. A few days later, I had a name, Mukti Biswas, who owned a small piece of land by the Bharagati River. And his family had been involved in the bone business going back at least a century. That name was connected to the cache of skulls that I had, and I tracked down the location of that bone factory. The night that I went to meet him, a tropical depression had hit the Bay of Bengal and was absolutely drenching Calcutta and the entire countryside of West Bengal. As I recall, the streets of Calcutta, walking just about anywhere, the water was at least up to my knees, flooding everyone's basement. And I drove out through these horrendously muddy roads, and I got stuck outside of the bone factory. I was still about a kilometer away from the actual bone factory, and it was late, dark as the night. And I clomped out of the car. And I remember these toads the size of boxing gloves hopping around in front of me. I'd never seen toads that big before or since. And I had a cop with me. I had a translator. I had my microphone. And I walked out to the river to the end of this muddy road. And I met a guy named Manoj Paul, who had this thin, wiry mustache just over his lip. And he looked young. I mean, probably no more than 24 or 25. And I said to him, "Do you know Mukti Biswas?" And the first words out of his lips were, "That bastard still owes me money," which is exactly what a reporter wants to hear when you go to a bone factory and meet a guy on the side of the river. And I asked him, "Well, what was he doing? Why does he owe him money?" And Manoj said that his family had been working at this bone factory for at least a century. And they would tell stories of when the British would land at a local airstrip and they would bring bags of bones to the aircraft, and those aircraft would fly away with the corpses of his area. And Manoj had been hired, and he made about $1.50 for every complete skeleton that he put together. And the factory, you know, it really wasn't much to look at, right? As I recall, this tarp lean-to that he was living underneath had 3 blue buckets in it. Not buckets, like those 80-gallon drums. And inside those drums, well, I didn't look inside those drums, but I imagine it was bones that were being cleaned off with caustic soda. And it was right by the river. And he explained the entire process of defleshing corpses and selling them abroad to me. But he didn't know where Mukti Biswas was. And naturally, I really wanted an interview with Mukti. And I shined my flashlight around the muddy house, and it landed on this yellow piece of cloth that I picked up and sort of looked at. And my translator turned to me and says, "You know that's a death shroud, right?" And I was a little freaked out. I wiped it off on my pants. And I eventually found some numbers for Mukti from this man. And we called him up to see what he could tell us. Mukti didn't answer that night, but his son actually did. And he said to me, well, it's no secret. We've been doing this family business for as long as I can remember. My father didn't do anything wrong. It is a tradition here. Which is really an interesting thing to hear. There was no hiding. And I asked the cops if it was illegal. And they said, well, yeah, it's illegal to rob graves, sure. But we don't really have witnesses for the grave robbing. All we have are dead bodies. And, well, he sort of looked off into the distance. Maybe he was a little philosophical at this point. And he said, and who would file the complaint? After all, the people were already dead. That is, of course, maybe a little bit facetious on his part, because it's not that hard to find people whose family members had gone missing from local graveyards. A few days later, I met this guy named Mohammed Mullah Box, who was a Muslim in a local village called Harbati. And he said that a few weeks before, grave robbers had come in and pulled the bodies of one of his neighbors out of the ground. And I believe, as I recall, she had been pregnant. And not only did they get her body, but also the fetus, which, as I said before, a fetal skeleton is super valuable. I asked him if he feared what would happen when he dies, if his skeleton might also get stolen. He said, of course he was. But then again, how can Mohammed Mullah Box file a police report against these grave robbers when you don't even know which grave robber it is? And then once you've reduced a skeleton or a human body to a skeleton, well, it's even harder to identify those remains, especially when you don't have dental records, DNA evidence, and things like that. And certainly the local cops aren't going to put in that sort of effort into an investigation. So how do the local people get justice? Well, in India, justice is a relative measure. There's a guy that I met just maybe a week later. His name was Javed Ahmed Khan. He was a local politician. And I like to think of him as sort of like part Elliot Ness and part Ralph Nader, and maybe a little bit of Al Capone thrown in there. Javed Ahmed Khan had a position in the local political party. He was a member of the local parliament. And in 2001, so about 7 years before I got there, he had heard about this skeleton trader organization called Young Brothers, and he knew that these people were at least partially responsible for the growth of the anatomy trade, because his local constituents had come to him and said, there's this terrible smell coming out of the building where it was, and that when they got onto their roofs and they looked down onto the roof of Young Brothers' building, they saw huge cauldrons of human body parts being boiled on the roof. Legs and arms and heads, all in there, all being processed out in the open. And when they tried to file a complaint with the local police department saying, hey, look, this guy is boiling bodies on the roof of this building, the local police said, well, it's a political problem. We're not going to deal with it. It's probably even legal. Which is, of course, totally insane. And when Javed Ahmed Khan heard this, well, he didn't go to the police. What he did is he got his thugs together, his local crew of roughnecks, and they all came in with bamboo canes, and they beat everyone up inside of Young Brothers, and they came away with papers showing international receipts to medical supply companies all around the world, in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, Europe, everywhere. These bones were going abroad. And again, in the late 80s, in 1985, they made selling human bones illegal. So this was proof that they were violating the local Indian Anatomy Act. And so he brought that evidence that he acquired through violence to the cops, and they filed a case against Vinesh Arun, who was the leader of Young Brothers, who spent a grand total of 2 nights in jail without any charges at the end. This is sadly a piece about justice in India that has infuriated me, but more importantly, has infuriated hundreds of millions of Indians all the time, is that justice moves at a snail's pace, and more often than not, justice never actually occurs. as a side note, and maybe this will be a piece that I do in the future, in a future podcast, this lack of justice in the rural areas has led to civil insurrections against the Indian government time and time again. It has fostered the Indian gangsters, the mafia, who don't just run racketeering and bootlegging and things like that, but they actually provide criminal courts for people who are so frustrated with the Indian courts that they're able to actually provide illegal justice, which actually can be enforced by their own violence. And this sort of alternate legal system fuels much of the problems that persist throughout India. At the time, Young Brothers was actually still around in Calcutta. You know, Javed Ahmed Khan had invaded it in 2001. Vinesh Arun had like a minor case that really went nowhere. And eventually, I just tracked down the address by opening up a phone book and finding the large yellow building somewhere in Calcutta. I forget exactly where. And as I walked over there, I happened to see Vinesh Arun walking into his building as my SUV pulled up outside, and I walked up to him and, well, actually, I was a young reporter and I was at a loss for words, but my translator grabbed my microphone and put it right into his face and said, "What about these cases that were filed against you? What about the human anatomy that you have been selling abroad?" And Vinesh, you know, was taken aback at first. Who's this white guy with his translator and this microphone? And he just looked at me. And as he was closing the door, he said, "Well, I won that case." And then the door slammed in my face. And I never actually got, I called him several times, and I never actually got more than that from the bone seller in chief. But I was able, through Javed's papers, to start to track down places where bones were coming from India. I called this one place called Osta International. It's in Canada, and it's an anatomy supply company, and you can go online and buy a really nice, pretty human skull from them. And I asked them where they got their bones from, and they all came from India. He just told me right over the phone. And he said, "Look, there's really no problem. Once they're in the mail, no laws are being broken." Which was sort of, well, that was actually a really interesting insight, because what happens when you cross international borders is that organ crimes, and honestly any crime, gets very, very difficult to prosecute, because there's no laws in Canada or the United States that say you can't import a human bone or even a whole human body. Human materials crisscross the globe all the time, so the only person who can get in trouble is the person in India who is doing this. But in India, it's legal to rob graves. The only thing that's not legal is to actually mail the bone. So it's a very narrow window where you can actually get someone in trouble. Well, I talked to this guy, and I think his name was Hans Rudiger, at Osta International. And he says, yeah, he sells bones all over the place. He gets them from Singapore through middlemen, and he was selling multiple skulls. And he said that, you know, the trade, it had become more difficult since the 80s to get skulls, but there was still actually a lot of interest in them. And plastic models, well, they'd gotten a lot better, but they still weren't as good. They didn't show the variations in the morphology and the changes that happened between all humans. And people wanted these human skulls. He also informed me that there was a company that he sold to called Dent Supply Rin, who bought massive quantities of human teeth because what they were making was this model called a Dexter, where they took a plastic skull and they put real human teeth in the plastic skull, and they would use it to train people how to do x-rays on human teeth. And there were lots of Dexters selling, and I believe they cost about $1,500 per model, and this was an enormous market for human teeth as well. Now, I don't know where you get human teeth. Maybe there's some particularly aggressive dentists in India. In fact, I have no doubt there's particularly aggressive dentists in India. But there's also graves. They also get pulled right out of skulls. And I looked around on various websites and eventually found a teeth wholesaler in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu who would sell you whole bundles of 1,000 human teeth for $300. This trade was massive. At the time, I was living in the South Indian city of Chennai. And, you know, I was outside of Calcutta, but I walked over to a local anatomy shop, which happened to be just across the street from a graveyard. And I went to them. I was like, hey, can I get a real human skull from you? And he said, yeah, you can, but it's going to take maybe a little while, and we're going to have to go steal it from across the street. And it would cost me, I think it was $75 to do that. You know, and since that story came out, it originally showed up in Wired magazine, where I traced the entire movement of human bodies from the graveyard to medical schools all over the world. I have gotten pretty much constant emails. You know, probably they come in, they were coming in once a week, and now they're coming in maybe once every couple months, from people asking for one of two things. They ask me, one, if I can provide them a connection for a real human skull. And that happens actually somewhat frequently. And the other thing that happens is when there's a natural disaster in a country like Haiti. I mean, there was a hurricane that hit Haiti not so long ago, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people died. I would get emails from people in Haiti saying, hey, I can get you a lot of bodies. Do you know anyone who wants to buy them? Man, this is just the crazy part of having this job. There is still an enormous appetite. And the really, really interesting thing about the market for human remains is that while we've gone mostly plastic in the United States, and mostly, we have actually really, really good and actually many varieties of plastic skeletons to study anatomy that I think are probably good enough, the supply of bones has decreased overall. Right? There's fewer bones leaving India. There's only like one or two houses that are really, really involved in this, which means we're no longer exporting 60,000 skeletons a year. We're exporting maybe a few thousand. But man, you know what happens with economics? When you have a constrained supply, the price, well, it goes up. A fully processed new anatomical skeleton can cost up to $15,000. At the height of the skeleton boom in the 1980s, where probably if you know any doctors who were trained in the 1980s in my father's generation, you will find that they were buying skeletons for only $300 for a box of bones. That increase has made the value and the incentives to get into the illegal bone business all the more valuable. It's interesting. There's also this guy named John's Bones in New York who has actually emailed me a few times. He's this young 20-year-old guy and is a really, really nice guy, but he has a ton of skeletons that he sells out of his Brooklyn warehouse. And he gets lots and lots of stories in like The Guardian and media. And his TikTok following is, it's probably 100,000, maybe a few 100,000 people follow him. And he holds up bones to the screen. He says, look at this interesting specimen. And you know, he says he gets them from all ethical sources, and I've talked to him a few times, and I think that he might believe that he does get them from ethical sources. But the thing is, all of these bones, the old ones, probably the new ones too, mostly originated with a crime. They originated with someone like Mukti Biswas or this Manoj Paul guy going in and robbing a grave and making that grave a commercial product. In the United States, the only bones that we regulate are bones that come from Native American tribes. And this is because of the antiquities dealing that happened in the 1800s and to some degree still today, where archaeologists, amateur archaeologists and treasure hunters would go to Indian lands and steal old Indian bones, and they would sell them in the Indian market and give them to museums. And the Indian tribe said, hey, these are our relatives. These are sacred relics. You cannot do that. And we actually passed a law that protected indigenous people in the United States, which was amazing. It is so good that we do that. So if you find an Indian bone, you can be prosecuted and put in jail if you hold on to it. But there still are hundreds of thousands of bodies that come from the other India, you know, not from the United States, not the native tribes here, but from India all the way over in Calcutta that are filling up our medical programs. And they exist in doctors' closets, in attics, at bone resellers around the country who still make money on a crime that has continued to be perpetuated and never addressed. A few medical programs, Stanford and I believe in Michigan, believe in Pittsburgh. They've tried to address this problem by burying some of these in anatomical specimens, but it's a really, really hard problem to deal with. You know, if you, my old university that I went to, I got most of my PhD done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they had a whole room full of skeletons too. I don't know where they all came from. In fact, most people don't want to know where they came from. No one wants to get rid of their skeletons because they're so hard to get now. One thing that I wrote about in my book, The Red Market, is that human materials, they always move up and never down the social hierarchy. They moved from the paupers at Burke and Hare's murder factory up into the medical schools there to train the doctors. They move up from the colonial holdings in India to well-paying doctors around the world. It's the same, actually, with every single body part, with every single piece of human material. In my book, The Red Market, On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers, I found many, many ways that human materials go from the third world to the first, and mostly with authorities looking the other way. And the reason that this happens is for two reasons. One is the idea of altruism, and the other is scientific progress. In the United States, we say that human materials can only be transferred from one place to another out of the goodness of a person's heart. You cannot sell a body part, you can only gift them. And because of this, there is a presumption on any human material that you find in America, that it was actually given. Because there's no registry for human body parts. There's no way to track things down. You can only trust the ethical intentions and presentation of the person selling those bones. The other thing, scientific progress, is that, hey, we need human body parts, right? We want our doctors to study on bones. We want, if someone is dying of kidney failure, they want a real ethically sourced kidney, right? There's no synthetic kidney market that actually works just yet. You need a heart, you need a heart. You can't take a pig heart. That doesn't work yet. So we're in this problem, right? We are all potential customers of the red market, right? If you have kidney failure, you don't want to spend your life on dialysis. You want a kidney. You have heart failure. You want a heart. And you don't really want to know where it comes from. These markets, they're always anonymous, right? When you get a kidney, the only way you ever find out who donated the kidney is if there's extensive consent forms offered on both sides of that arrangement. The kidney donor's family said, yes, they want to be contacted, and you have to want to be contacted. And otherwise, all of that is sealed behind the wall of privacy that we called HIPAA, which is medical privacy directives. And if a whole bunch of stars don't align, you can never trace the path of a human material through our economic systems. This provides cover for criminals, and it happens time and again. It happens with blood. It happens with bones. It happens with human hair. It happens with eggs. It even happens with whole children when I investigated the market for kidnapped children into the adoption industry. My book, The Red Market, is terrifying. It's terrifying because we don't want to think of our own bodies as commercial products. We want to think of ourselves as somehow immutable and special, and that when our corpse goes out of our control when we die, that something respectful happens to it. I mean, hey, you could will yourself to an anatomical museum or a doctor's office or whatever you want. You can do that of your own free will, and that is great. I have no problem with that. But there's also a lot of theft. There's also funeral homes in the United States, which routinely get busted for harvesting the skin and even bones for bone graft industries and corneas, illegally enclosed casket funerals. And you never really know what's going to happen with a relative's dead body. I'm a little surprised that we don't have anatomy riots anymore. It's crazy because, honestly, in the modern world, we are so afraid of even talking about death that talking about crimes that happen after death is something that we are just too terrified to do. And yet it's still going on. I want to thank you for spending some time looking at the bone trade with me. There is so much more to go into, but I've been talking now for about 40 minutes. And if you want to know more, there's a great audiobook for The Red Market I recorded myself, and it is a riveting text. It is one of the, I mean, it is the first book that I ever fully wrote, and it's still one of the most important. It still gets picked up by medical schools and anthropology departments around the country, and I would love you to listen. I think it's something that we all have to face, because there is a time that all of us are going to die, and it's interesting to know what might happen if we're not more aware of the industries around us. If you want more updates about what I'm doing, I have what is probably the best newsletter on the entire internet, and I would love you to subscribe. You can do so on my website, scottcarney.com. You can also look into the show notes here, and I will provide a link that you can go find me, and I will be in your inbox every week. Sometimes every 2 weeks, and sometimes once a month, depending on how things are going. Thank you so much. From Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado, this is Scott Carney Investigates.